temperatures are going to be unseasonably balmy this long weekend in the Maritimes, Quebec and Ontario, with forecasts in the high 20s for southern Ontario. Environment Canada says such warmth so late in the year is unprecedented in 1.5 centuries of record keeping.
You know, here in New York, we just had the warmest October day on record. It was 87 degrees yesterday.
None of those weather forecasts mentioned the two dread words, global warming. Everybody they interview says, yeah, this is great. I could live like this. 87 in New York in October. I gotta love that. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Today we're going to hear about the two biggest banks in the world and how they're paying for just more and more coal plants in the United States so we can really burn, baby, burn. But first, you know, we're going to hear from the Supreme Green activist, Derek Jensen, as he tells us about another way.
Speaking of the environment, tonight a new winter forecast from government scientists warns of a double whammy for some areas of this nation already struggling with epic drought. The first forecast is for warmer than normal temperatures across much of the South. And the second calls for a higher than normal chance of drier than normal conditions in the hard hit Southeast. NBC's Martin Savage reports now.
In Alabama, Lake Martin is dropping at the rate of a foot a week. Unless there's a quick fix, Alexander City could be out of drinking water in just days.
Never seen nothing like this before. This is, we've had droughts before, but I've never seen this lake get this low.
The worst drought in 150 years continues to tighten its grip on the Southeast. In the Carolinas, 1 million people drink from the Catawba River system. 2 million get their power from it. Last March and April, there was so much water, areas were inundated.
Homes were flooded. So we went from flood conditions to severe drought in 6 months.
These aren't normal times.
According to the latest government drought report, portions of 6 southern states earn an exceptional rating, the worst there is. And the impact could soon be felt nationwide. In Alabama, cotton for the clothing industry is failing in the field.
We're losing a bale of cotton every day.
In Georgia, hay for cattle has burned up. In countless places, watering the lawn, washing the car, or even filling a swimming pool ended long ago. Now, residents in Athens, Georgia have been warned to prepare they could be without water by year's end. To cut water usage even more, Atlanta today raised watering fines up to $1,000. Martin Savage, NBC News, Lake Wylie, South Carolina.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith. Today we're going to challenge your thinking and maybe even your way of life. My guest is Derek Jensen, a prolific environmental writer, speaker, and advocate for nature. To some, he is the bad boy of the green movement, and to many more, a guiding light. Derek, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I have some difficult questions, the kind that we all face, and I'm hoping you're going to be able to help me out a little bit, as maybe we can work through them together.
Uh-huh.
Here is one. I've just heard a speech by Joel Covell on eco-socialism, and he seems to offer a new version of Marxism where the revolution no longer depends upon the working class, and I'm perplexed. What do you think about a marriage of environmentalism to this Marxist-style socialism?
Well, I can't comment specifically on him because I don't know his work. But in general, the problem isn't merely capitalism, which of course is one of the problems. Part of the problem is industrialism. I mean, it doesn't matter whether the workers are, whether the factories are controlled by, Bill Gates or Dick Cheney or the horny-handed workers. You know, it still ends up requiring inputs. I mean, if you have a pulp mill that's owned by the workers, you still have, you're still going to be pulping forests. And it still costs you more than $1 billion, which means that for it to be economical, it needs to run 24 hours a day, which means it needs to consume forests everywhere. And so the problems, once again, I mean, I don't know his particular perspective, but I know Marxism in general, if it doesn't question, or anything, if it doesn't question industrialism, it's just a continuation of the same old anthropocentrism.
Well, I agree, and I think you've cut right to the point on that one. Well, looking at your own work, I know you have a book out titled Thought to Exist in the Wild, Awakening from the Nightmare of Zoos. Why zoos and why now?
I'm sorry to say that the actual reason for that book is pretty prosaic, which is that years ago I became acquainted with Karen Tweedy Holmes and her work. She's a photographer in that book. And I love the work so much that I wanted to do a book with her. And so it wasn't, because she had the photographs of zoos, that pretty much determined the subject. And so that, once again, is not a very exciting reason. But, of course, zoos are just horrid, horrid things. And I was really glad once I got into it to be able to do my best for, you know, as a writer, for the incarcerated animals. And, I mean, if you want, we can talk about the, what are some of the conclusions there, or we can go a different direction, whatever you'd like to do.
Well, I'd just like to remark that sometimes, you know, I've lived out in the bush myself, even without electricity for many years, and And now when I walk by a concrete apartment block and I look up and I see people moving about in their boxes, I think about zoos. I mean, aren't we also captured animals?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the points that I make in there that I was pretty pleased with, was that zoos teach terrible things about so-called habitat by taking animals out of their context. You know, if you take a wolverine out of its area, you still have a wolverine, and that's just nonsense. I mean, a wolverine is part of its surroundings. I mean, that's what makes the wolverine, and that's what makes the surroundings. And anyway, so they've gone away from bars and toward glass and moats and everything, and the reason is because it's less obvious it's a cage. And the same is true for us. As we get more and more metabolized into the system, we need less and less of, we need fewer and fewer bars, and, you know, we can have our quote habitat instead of real habitat.
Well, the way it is now, I mean, you can live a great deal of your life and not know whether the moon is out or what phase it's in.
Well, that's a big part of, that's a huge part of the problem, too, is that, and that's, John A. Livingston wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. One of the things he talks about in there that was very important to my understanding was that a lot of times when people go to cities, he says, well, they are, you know, people will say, that I went to the city and I was overwhelmed by all the sounds. And so they think it's like sensory overload. And John A. Livingston made the point that it's not actually sensory overload, it's sensory deprivation in a sense, because everything is that surrounds you is of human origin or is mediated by humans. Like right now, I mean, I live out in the country, but I'm inside right now. And so, you know, I see, the paint and plaster on the walls. I see photographs of human beings. I see a needlepoint thing of a wolf, but it was done by my mom. And I look out through the window, and through this little itty-bitty space, you know, I can see some wild. And I think about this, you know, how many machines are within, you know, 10 feet of you right now, or 20 feet, and how many wild animals are within 50 feet? And how many machines do you have a daily relationship with versus how many wild animals do you have, or plants do you have a daily relationship with? And one of the reasons this is really important is because, as, I mean, John A. Livingston makes clear that when you are in an echo chamber, when you're surrounded only by sounds of your own origin, essentially, you go insane. And he says, and I agree with this, that most of our ideologies, or I don't know if he says most, but our ideologies are hallucinations. I mean, all this attention to the stock market as the world is destroyed. I mean, if all you see around you is your own making, then it makes more sense that you're going to become really, really, really narcissistic, because nothing else exists. and from your perspective. And we see this, for example, in all of the so-called solutions that are presented to global warming. It's pretty stunning because they all take the economic system as a given and the natural world as a dependent variable, as something that can, basically we can take it or leave it. And that's all wrong. I mean, that's an inverse of physical reality. The real story is that physical reality is primary, and whatever economic system is layered over the top of it is secondary. And it's a measure of our insanity and stupidity that there's all these solutions that are all predicated on attempting to maintain this way of life that's so clearly killing the planet. That's just stunning. And I did an interview down, it was horrible. It was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, and the interviewer was out of Santa Barbara, California, and he was terrible. He was a right-wing, anti-environmental Bible thumper, and I guess he just wanted an environmentalist to yell at for a while. And as we're talking, I was saying things like, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, or, 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the oceans, there's dachs in every mother's breast milk, all the stuff we all know. And he kept saying, Derek, let's get back to the real world. And what the real world was for him was industrial capitalism. And it's just like when people are in college, a lot of times they'll say, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what they really mean is, what do you do when you go into the job market? That's not the real world. The real world is this that tree right there, and that tree right there, and that bush. And, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt. And so that's a really fundamental problem that zoos perpetuate, by the way, too, and that cities perpetuate, is this belief that that what is social is what's primary, but what's primary is the real physical world.
Without that, we don't have a place to stand. Well,
I have a great new line, which is, protect your land base. You can't have sex without it.
A good bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Well, recently a room full of college students, as you know, watched a classmate arrested and then tasered for asking John Kerry inconvenient questions. And what got me was the crowd just sat there without a murmur as though they were watching TV. Are you concerned the next generation will passively watch the destruction of nature, the end game?
The next generation? What about the current generation?
Well, I'm talking about young people here. I'm talking about college people.
I think the vast majority of people will never resist. And one of the things that really convinced me of that was Zygmunt Bauman's extraordinary book, Modernity and the Holocaust. And in there, he talks about one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. So the question is, would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. And what Zygmunt Bauman says about that is that rational people go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And I would change that a little bit and say that rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that buying compact fluorescence is going to save the day. And so I think that most people are going to be won't resist, and most people will go to the end of the world, just leave me alone and let me watch my television. And on the other hand, I think that there will be increasingly there will be people who join with the living planet as it becomes increasingly obvious this system is not working. And and there will be increasing numbers of people who do resist.
Well, I got to ask, what about the rest of us? Sometimes late at night after hearing news of stories of birds disappearing worldwide and the fish going away and the algae and the frogs and the bees, we get a sickening rage swelling up inside of us, and I know you felt that. What can we do with our rage about human brutality to nature?
I think that I'm so glad that you asked the question, what can we do with it, as opposed to what can we do about it? Because so often, so many people think that rage is something to be avoided. But, rage is just something to feel when there's something is outrageous. And just like despair is appropriate to feel in a desperate situation, and sorrow is appropriate to feel. We spend so much energy trying to avoid those bad feelings. But I just, for one thing, I just feel them. And then I use them to spur my action. I mean, years ago, this activist told me, I love this, it was about 10, 12 years ago now, and this one activist said to me that the only things that are keeping you going are rage and sorrow. And I don't really agree with that, because there's also love. But rage and sorrow certainly fuel my work, and love, and hate, and joy, and all those things. And so I think the thing, one of the reasons also that I think that we feel so frustrated is because so often we'll be presented with problems, and then the solutions that are presented to us are so obviously designed to simply be theater. And we know that in our bodies, and it creates this huge disjuncture. I mean, it's like you hear about how this, you know, some whole situation is so horrible, and then at the end you're told to write your representatives, you know, when we all know that the representatives serve the corporation. They don't serve us. They certainly don't serve the natural world. And that's a tremendous source of, I think, what's the word? That's a tremendous source of malaise. That's a source of burnout, because we keep doing the same things and they're not working. Well, instead of quitting, maybe we should try different things. And I can't say what those things are, except to say that we need to come up with options that are not constrained by those in power, because those in power are not going to allow anything to occur that in any way diminishes their power. And one of the most important things I think we can do is recognize that laws are made up by those in power to serve those in power. And I'm not saying that all laws are bad. I'm saying that we should pick and choose, and we should recognize that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the legality of something and the morality of something. And that's not really a point that's new. I mean, Martin Luther King made the same point when he talked about how everything that was done in Nazi Germany was legal, and everything done on the Underground Railroad, I think he said, it might have been something else, everything done on the Underground Railroad was illegal. And I think we need to determine for ourselves what we think is right and what we think is wrong.
I'm speaking with Derek Jensen, a leading author in the deep ecology movement. Derek, I've read your two-volume book, Endgame, and I feel it should be required reading for college students. It's part of a series of books that convinced me you are a legitimate philosopher in the old and deep meaning of that word. But for me and for many, you are sometimes a philosopher of last resort. I'm sure you've deconstructed our resistance to your message. What is it made of?
That's a good question. I've never gotten that one before. What is the resistance to my message made of?
Yes. Why do we people... You know, we know you exist, or at least some people do. The media seems to kind of suppress your existence. Even those... You know, there's something about it. I read it, I want to agree, and yet I'm sort of holding off to the last minute my agreement. Why?
Well, because what I'm talking about, which is bringing down civilization, is pretty drastic. And, I mean, frankly, in a sense, it's a last resort for me, too. I mean, I didn't spring full-blown from, you know, my mother's loins knowing this. But actually, I probably did. You know, I'm an infant, as an animal. We all know it, and we get socialized out of it. But it took me a long time to get back here and to recognize that the system is not redeemable. And that's in some ways a bitter pill to swallow, and in some ways, I mean, it's to recognize that this experiment is not only atrocious and atrocity-inducing, but a miserable failure on every level, and it can't continue. This experiment called civilization, and of course, indigenous peoples worldwide agree, and, you know, polar bears agree, and great ox agreed before they were exterminated, and so did passenger pigeons, but, you know, it's a system that's not working, and there's a tremendous, it's really interesting that when you look at like an abusive family dynamic, it's very interesting. Everything is set up to protect the abuser. Everything. All their actions, all their inactions, they're all about protecting the abuser from the effects of his own behavior and from feeling the stuff that causes him to do this in the first place, him or her, but usually him. And it's similar with this culture that will do anything to avoid looking at the situation. And there's this great, In the 1960s, this guy Lester Laborsky did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs. He would track where they would look. He would show them photographs. And it was very interesting because what he found is that if a photograph contained something that the person found morally objectionable but that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once even track to it, which means that they would see it out of the corners of their eyes and then they would not look there. And when they were asked later, was this thing in the photograph, they would say no, and they'd be telling the truth because they didn't see it. And there's a story I remember reading about the head drug enforcement agency guy in Colombia. His wife was arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And one of the stories that both of them told was that she would do lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room, and he wouldn't even see it. And, I mean, I know that I have in my life been in some relationships that are not very good, and, you know, all my friends go, you know, they tell me, they try to point out something, and I, you know, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then when the relationship's over, it's like, oh my gosh, how did I not see that? You know, we're really good at avoiding looking at things. And another way to say this, Artie Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. And rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence rules A, A1, or A2. So we can talk forever about Britney Spears or Angelina Jolie or right. any of that, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can't talk about the fact that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. The oceans are effectively murdered. And we can't talk about that. We can't talk about the fact that the world's governments spend more money to subsidize commercial fishing fleets in the ocean than the actual value of the catch. So we would all be better off if the governments would just pay them the money to stay home. And we can't talk about any of that stuff. We can't talk about the fact that this culture is killing the planet. And so that's where that comes in, is that we're trained very, very early on to not talk about, to not look, oh, here's another one. I love this story. This was a central metaphor of my book, The Culture of Make-Believe. It's the story of Ham and Noah. And the story of Ham and Noah is that Ham was one of Noah's sons, and Noah one night got drunk and passed out naked in his tent. And Ham went in and saw him and went out and told his brothers, and then his brothers would walk in backwards and so they wouldn't see their father's nakedness, and then they covered him with a garment. And the next day when Noah woke up, he was really mad at what Ham had done, and he cursed him forever, which is really convenient for white people because, according to some stories, Ham was the ancestor of the Africans when it made it okay to enslave them. But be that as it may, I wondered when I read that story when I was a kid, I didn't understand it. It didn't make any sense to me at all. And only when I was writing that book did it suddenly make sense to me that it's the central cautionary tale of any oppressive system, which is, if you see the patriarch, if you see the oppressor, those in power, if you see them naked, that is, as they are, and you talk about it, then you must be cursed because you've committed blasphemy. And that's the worst thing that one, from the perspective of the oppressor, one of the worst things you can do is to look at them as they are and to talk about them as they are. And so I think that that's part of the resistance, too. And it's weird because on one level, there is some resistance, and on another level, there's not. I mean, I was in Vancouver a while back, and the hall where we were was sold out at Langara. And I routinely, in the West especially, will have 400, 600, 700 people at a talk. So it's always been a little bit confusing for me because, on one hand, you know, I've got huge numbers of people go to talks oftentimes, and which is not always true. And like in New York City, I'll have like 30 people. It's very dependent on geography. But anyway, lots of people will come up, but there's essentially no media attention, and I can understand that.
Well, you know, if you'll give me a minute to explain, I have a criticism of your work as I perceive it that's kind of related to what you just described, and that is, I'm wondering if your vision needs to expand beyond the West Coast style of tree protection and cell phone towers and dams. I mean, you woke me up to the crazy number of destructive dams blocking nature all over. I thank you for that, and they must come down. But I propose we have even more urgent problems now, and forgive me if I've misread you or missed this, but would you agree to a sort of bastard adaptation of your work, something like this, that says, Well, whatever we can do, whatever it takes, we'll stop three things. One, the coal trade, the mines, the trains, shut the coal power stations down, don't build any more. Two, no nuclear power. And three, don't make any more cars. Shut down the auto industry. The planet can't take another single personal carbon machine. So here are three rapid-fire questions about this
I wouldn't say that's accurate.
You wouldn't say that last one?
I wouldn't say any of those.
You wouldn't say any of those. Okay, well, now we're getting somewhere. Because I'm worried about the small window to save the climate and whether you're engaged with that or have you always been and I missed it. What's your reaction to what I've been saying here?
Well, what I want people to do is to think clearly about our predicament and to ask, if you want to achieve a certain thing, ask how you're going to go about doing it. And so if, for example, one of the examples I use in Endgame is if you care about salmon, what salmon need are six things, I think, to survive. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. And they need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop. And those are all straightforward technical tasks. That doesn't mean they're easy. It doesn't mean they're not daunting. But let's break it down. And so if you want global warming to not run away, what do you need to do? One of the things you need to do is you need to stop the industrial economy. And how do you do that? Well, okay, let's start asking those questions. And because the problem is not and has never been how do we do this technically. The problem is wrapping our mind around the severity of the problem and doing something about it. And there can be a bazillion different things. I mean, I want to be really clear that although I'm calling for taking down the entire industrial economy, I think that there's one of the nice things about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's really good work to be done. So if what somebody is called to do is to work at a rape crisis hotline, that's great. Or if somebody wants to do rehabilitation work for a stream, that's great. Somebody wants to be an attorney, that's great. Somebody wants to learn explosives, that's great. It's like we need everything. And so that's the hesitation I have on focusing on cars or nuclear power or anything is that I think because somebody could easily say, but gosh, I really love spotted owls. And, you know, nuclear power doesn't really have anything right now to do with spotted owls. And so, you know, I don't want to dissuade that person from working to protect spotted owls. And I also want to back off on what I said. When I said the East Coast, I really did mean New York City itself. And, like, when I go to Michigan, it's a packed house. And when I go to North Carolina, it's a packed house. And so there is a geographical difference that I have a much bigger audience in the Northwest. But New York and D.C. actually are anomalies that are really small. So I don't think I need to change the message for the East. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's good enough. I'm wondering if there's anything else I've missed. Is there something else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think one of the important things to remember, and it's embarrassing even to have to say this, is that the only measure by which we're going to be judged by the people who come after is going to be the health of the land base. And they're not going to care about whether we wrote really good books, and they're not going to care about whether we did a really good radio show, and they're not going to care about whether we were vegetarians, they're not going to care about whether we drove, we recycled, whatever. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. They're going to care about whether the land provides them with food. And when I was talking about the salmon or anything else, I want to come back to this very quickly, that global warming scares me very, very much. And it scares me more than almost anything. And so, yes, I think that we need to do whatever it takes to stop global warming. And the good news about global warming that I've heard is all the predictions that they make on, you know, how much the temperature is going to rise, those are all based on the continuation of the industrial economy. They don't take, for example, peak oil into account. I've asked people a bunch of times this question because I think it's a crucial question. They don't take peak oil into account. They don't take actually people stopping the industrial economy into account. And once again, that may sound like a pipe dream. You know, oh, yeah, stop the industrial economy, wink, wink. This guy's a lunatic. But the only thing I can think of that's even crazier than that is allowing this insane system to kill the planet. I mean, this is not a computer game where we get to go back and do it again. This is real life.
We've been speaking with Derek Jensen. You can tune into all his books and some of his new projects at derekjensen.org. Thanks for being so generous with your time and your work.
You.
For sure. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and thanks for listening.
As you've heard, Derek really is a gentleman and a scholar. His arguments seemed way out there a few years ago, but get stronger every day we head further over the edge toward the end of nature. We need to shake up our minds, make up your own mind, and get active however you can. That's my opinion. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.com. .org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. We all want to stop the global warming disaster, but in case you've missed the full-page ad in the New Yorker magazine, September 14th, 2007, I'd like to read you just a bit. It says, "Global warming, think you're making a difference? Think again. There are 151 new conventional coal-fired power plants in various stages of development in the U.S. today. Home Depot is funding the planting of 300,000 trees in cities across the U.S. to help absorb carbon dioxide or CO2 emissions. The CO2 emissions from only one medium-sized 500-megawatt coal-fired power plant in just 10 days of operation will negate this entire effort. Walmart is investing $500 million to reduce the energy consumption and CO2 emissions of their existing buildings by 20% over the next 7 years. If every Walmart supercenter meets this target, the CO2 emissions from only one medium-sized coal-fired power plant in just 1 month of operation each year would negate this entire effort. California passed legislation to cut CO2 emissions in new cars by 25% and in SUVs by 18% starting in 2009. If every car and SUV sold in California in 2009 met this standard, the CO2 emissions from only one medium-sized coal-fired power plant in just 8 months of operation each year would negate this entire effort. If every household in the U.S. changed a 60-watt incandescent light bulb to a compact fluorescent, the CO2 emissions from just two medium-sized coal-fired power plants each year would stop this entire effort. And talk about campuses. The Campus Climate Challenge calls for all college campuses in the U.S. to reduce their CO2 emissions to zero. If every college campus building in the U.S. met this challenge, the CO2 emissions from just four medium-sized coal-fired power plants each year would negate this entire effort. And on it goes, and they're talking about 150 new ones, in this ad placed by a group called Architecture 2030. They say there is a silver bullet for solving the global warming crisis. No more coal. You can check out my own radio special on this, End Coal Now, or The Earth Burns, at our website at ecoshock.org. Now, the Rainforest Action Network, known as RAN, is going right to the source of this coal-building craziness, the world's two largest banks who finance construction. The RAN people have a consistent record of going after the right targets on things that matter most, and often win. They get my green seal of approval. I'm going to take you inside the campaign with the latest RAND conference call for journalists. Listen in. America still plans to build more than 100 new dirty coal plants, even as we approach the tipping point of climate catastrophe.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
How long? Get this going on.
Yeah, they're working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine. Whoops.
Today you will listen into a conference call for journalists as the Rainforest Action Network and its allies try to stop the two biggest banks who finance most of the coal power expansion in the country. Rebecca Tarbottom of RAN is joined by author and activist Bill McKibben. Judy Bonds, the Goldman Environment Prize winner and founder of Coal River Mountain Watch, gives you the lowdown on what is really happening in Appalachia. And then we have Leslie Lowe of the Interfaith Council Center for Corporate Responsibility talking about how big companies are all part of this problem. This call was recorded on October 2, 2007. You can get the longer version with questions from the journalists at www.ran.org/presskit. If that disappears, you can always download this file from the 2007 climate files of ecoshock.org.
Thank you, everyone, for joining the call. My name is Rebecca Tarbottom, and I'm the director of Rainforest Action Network's Global Finance Campaign. So we are honored and excited to be on this call today with representatives of the rapidly growing movement in the U.S. to stop the coal rush, who have joined us for this launch of our campaign, Rainforest Action Network's campaign, to stop banks from funding any new coal development. And just to give a little bit of background about coal and why we're talking about it today, from cradle to grave, coal is dirty. From its extraction by methods such as mountaintop removal that literally blows the tops off mountains and pushes the waste into valley bottoms, to its transportation over vast distances by rail, and to when it's finally burned, poisoning the air with mercury and other dangerous elements, which cause over 24,000 premature deaths per year, according to the American Lung Association. But as if this weren't damning enough, globally, coal-fired power plants are the single largest source of carbon dioxide emissions, greater than tropical deforestation or use of oil for transportation. And this makes coal use the leading cause of climate change. Recognizing this, I'm sure many people have heard, scientists including Dr. James Hansen, NASA's top climate scientists, and politicians such as Al Gore, Senators John Edwards and John Kerry, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and governors across the country have been calling for an immediate halt to new coal development, for a moratorium, effectively. But at the same time, the U.S. Department of Energy is proposing to build 150 new coal plants that would effectively lock us into dirty energy for another 50 years, adding between 600 million and 1.1 billion tons of additional CO2 emissions every single year. And this would basically negate every other single effort currently on the table to combat climate change, just to give you a sense of how the magnitude of what we're talking about. So RAN always likes a good fight, and this was one we just could not pass up. And when we asked ourselves who was behind this rush to build more coal, and when we followed the money, we came to the banks. We're not the only ones who've come to this conclusion, and some of the other groups who are dedicated to fighting coal and climate change have joined us here today. We have with us Bill McKibben, author, environmentalist, and founder of Step It Up, the largest demonstrations against global warming in U.S. history. We have Judy Bonds, founder of Coal River Mountain Watch, a coalfield resident, and Goldman Environmental Prize winner, and Leslie Lowe, Energy and Environment Program Director, Interfaith Council Center on Corporate Responsibility. So we'll start off by hearing from all of them before I tell you more about Rainforest Action Network's plans and our targets for the coming years. And so who'll kick us off is Bill McKibben. Do you want to start off, Bill?
Sure, I'd love to. You know, everybody's already seen the front page of today's New York Times. Everybody's seen the picture of a Arctic in retreat so fast that even the scientists who spent their lives studying this are unnerved, shaken, spooked by what's going on. I wrote the first book about climate change for a general audience 20 years ago, a book called The End of Nature. The only thing that's changed in that 20 years scientifically is our understanding that this problem is much larger than we had understood then and coming much faster. The other insight that we've really come to in recent years is that the final question as to whether or not we're going to be able to address global warming in any serious fashion is whether the coal that's currently in the ground stays there or not. There's very little doubt that we're going to burn most of the oil that we can get our hands on because we've gotten our hands on most of it and it's intensely valuable. Coal, on the other hand, is the question. And if the 150 power plants that are on the books in one form or another in this country ever get built, any significant percentage of them, then there's no use sitting here talking about compact fluorescent light bulbs or mass transit or any of the other things that everybody's talking about and working on. They'll pour enough carbon into the atmosphere, and the ones in China and India following that lead will pour enough carbon into the atmosphere that we'll have no hope of averting global warming short of catastrophic proportions. The other thing that's changed in the last year or two is a real political upswing of concern and interest that will lead, in short order, I think, to the U.S. beginning to regulate carbon the way that other countries in the developed world have begun to in the last few years. When we organized with no money and no organization. This series of protests last spring, for instance, at stepitup07.org, in just a few weeks we managed to put together 1,400 rallies in all 50 states. Work like that for many people has, and Al Gore chief among them, has led to legislation being very seriously considered on Capitol Hill that will put deep restrictions on carbon, cap carbon, and ratchet down those caps year after year for the lifetime of everybody on this phone call. And by the time that that process has gotten even a few years down the road, anybody who's investing in coal plants now will recognize the folly of what they're doing. Coal looks cheap at the moment, but that's only because we count nothing, we charge it nothing for the environmental damage that it's doing. And when we do, you need to be a real sucker to want anything to do with burning new coal in particular. So one way to say it is to think that though it may not be our goal, our effect today will be to help enormously these banks by keeping them out of the next big mess that they're headed for, thinking that they're investing in a fuel that looks cheap at the moment but is about to become as expensive fiscally as it already is environmentally.
Thanks very much, Bill. Really appreciate that contribution. So next we'll move on to Judy Bonds, and Julia Judy Bonds, who's the founder of Coal River Mountain Watch, is a coalfield resident, and as I said before, a Goldman Environmental Prize winner. Over to you, Judy.
Okay. Greetings from almost level southern West Virginia. We used to be the Mountain State. My family has been here for 10 generations, and I'm a real underground coal miner's daughter and granddaughter. Here in Appalachia, in the coal-producing communities of Appalachia, we're living in a war zone. We live in terror every day, and I want these banks in America to understand that the banks are funding this war on Appalachia, and they're funding domestic terrorism. In West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, parts of Maryland, we're being bombed every day. Just in West Virginia alone, there's 3.5 million pounds of explosives used daily. It's fertilizer and diesel fuel, and we found out that they're using some old Army munitions. The communities near these mountaintop removal sites are covered in silica, rock dust, coal dust, and we can smell and taste the explosives after they blast it that filters down into our valleys and the places we call haulers. They damage our homes, and they shake our nerves, and they're poisoning our air. The denuded forests increase runoff during rain events, and our children have slept fully clothed, ready to run, and they plot escape routes. We have poisoned water from the selenium and mercury and the chemicals that they use. They build 1 billion gallons of toxic coal waste sludge dams on top of these mountains that hover over our homes and our communities and our schools. They poison our surface water from the runoff from these sludge dams, and recently they've run out of places to store this waste. So what they do is they take a pipe and they underground inject this sludge, this toxic sludge, into old abandoned shafts, and it's leaching into our water wells, and they're poisoning our water. They're literally poisoning the East Coast water supply, and they're turning central Appalachia into a toxic wasteland. West Virginia is the poorest state, and the coal-producing counties and the communities in this state are the poorest communities. The banks are helping coal to take the wealth from us, to steal us blind and leave us in poverty and leave us in poison. They destroy our mountain culture. If you don't have mountains, you can't have mountaineers. You can't have hillbillies without hills, and I'm proud to be both. So I ask these banks to stop funding killer coal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julia. Leslie Lowe is the Energy and Environment Program Director at the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and now I'll pass it over to you, Leslie.
Thank you, Becky. The Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, or ICCR, is a faith-based institution of over 275 institutional investors. We are fiduciaries for natural, social, moral, and finance capital. In looking at the prospect of a warming planet, which will destroy the creation and unalterably change life for future generations, we as people of faith are committed to seeing global warming stopped and at least action taken to mitigate the harm that we have already caused. To embark on a program of building new coal power plants, especially plants that are fed with coal taken from Appalachia under the conditions that Judy Bonds just described, is, under any faith-based view of the world, blasphemy and a sin. It is to profit from the destruction of the natural world, from the destruction of communities, and from the poisoning of humans and other life on this planet. As investors, when we look at the proposition of financing 50-year assets that are going to add to the greenhouse gas emissions of this country and of the companies that are sponsoring these plants, we must step back and say, what are they thinking? This is a time of great uncertainty. Uncertainty as to the extent of the impacts of climate change. And as Mr. McKibben has just pointed out, these changes are happening far more rapidly and having much greater effect than we had supposed. They are also, again, caused by our own actions and our own decisions. So when we look at the proposition of financing coal plants, and as investors, we are looking at the future return from these plants, we have to wonder, what are they thinking? It is clear that we will have carbon limits in this country. It will impose a cost for carbon pollution, so that every coal plant that emits more CO2 is going to be a liability long term. We are looking at plants, some of which are using dirty old coal technology, not even the newer integrated gasification combined cycle or IGCC technology. But even IGCC has problems. Although it reduces emissions considerably, it is not as clean as natural gas, and it still requires carbon capture and storage technology to make it truly carbon neutral and get even close to 90% carbon reductions. We are concerned that carbon capture and storage is still in experimental stages, that the infrastructure for this technology at utility scale does not exist. We don't even know if we have enough geological formations, and we already know that there are probably not enough oil wells in this country to handle the waste at utility scale. So there are many, many questions here, and asking investors to put money into new coal-fired plants is like saying that you can smoke cigarettes without exhaling. It's simply not possible. We're also concerned that if you build it, they may not come. We are at the end of the era of cheap energy, and consumers are looking for ways to conserve, for more efficient ways to accomplish their goals. Nobody wants to use energy just to use energy. It's to accomplish an end, and we certainly in this country can find much more efficient ways to achieve our ends. And finally, many utility companies are finding business models that are profitable in demand-side management. Look at California. So for those reasons, from an investment perspective, we think that this is the new folly, building coal plants.
Thank you very much, Leslie. So as I said at the beginning, my name is Rebecca Tarbottom, and I'm the Global Finance Campaign Director at Rainforest Action Network. And I'm just going to wrap up this section of the call by giving an overview of the campaign that we're launching and our targets. We've heard about the growing movement to combat climate change from Bill McKibben. We've heard about the tremendously, almost unimaginable effects of coal extraction from Judy Bonds, and some of the reasons why investors are starting to really raise heck about investments in carbon-intensive industries, particularly coal, from Leslie Lowe. As I said in the introduction, when RAND decided to take on this issue, we simply followed the money. Where was it coming from? Who was financing this? And our analysis shows that the coal rush is being financed by a handful of banks, and two of them continue to rise to the top again and again, Bank of America and Citi. Citi is the leading financier of fossil fuel energy around the world and the world's top financier of coal specifically. With assets of $2.2 trillion, Citi is the world's largest bank as well as the world's largest company, according to Forbes. As many of you on this call might already know, in 2000, RAND launched a campaign against Citi that in 2004 resulted in Citi's announcement of what was then an industry-leading policy addressing environmental and human rights concerns associated with project finance. And while there's no doubt that this policy represented an important step towards the goal of socially and ecologically responsible banking, to date, Citi has largely ignored the issue of how their financed greenhouse gas emissions are contributing to the largest environmental crisis of our time, climate change. For example, some facts and figures. Today, Citi is a top underwriter for the coal industry in general, issuing twice the amount of money to this sector in 2006 as its closest competitor. Citi is also the top underwriter for American Electric Power, which is the single largest greenhouse gas emitter in the U.S., as well as one of the top buyers of mountaintop removal coal from Appalachia. AEP is proposing to build 5 coal-fired power plants in the near future, expanding its claim to the dubious title of single largest source of climate change in the U.S. Citi is also the top underwriter for Dynegy that now incorporates LS Power. And this is the company that is proposing the largest build-out of coal-fired power plants of any corporation in the country, currently planning on building 8 plants around the U.S. Bank of America has also participated in billions of dollars of financing towards new coal-fired power plants, but where this bank truly excels is in bankrolling mountaintop removal and strip mining, the effects of which you've heard of today on this call. In fact, the biggest companies responsible for mountaintop removal all are financed by Bank of America. A couple of examples, Massey Energy, currently being sued by the Environmental Protection Agency for violating the Clean Water Act, no less than 4,633 times is backed by Bank of America. Likewise, Bank of America is the go-to bank for Peabody Energy, the world's largest coal company with mines all over the world, as well as the company responsible for ravaging Hopi and Diné lands in New Mexico for the past 40 years. The irony of both Citi and Bank of America's coal portfolios, as I'm sure is not lost on any of the people on the call today, is that both of these banks are vying for top position as the greenest and most climate-friendly banks. So our question to them is, if you really take climate seriously, how can you justify continuing to finance the dirtiest, most carbon-intensive industry in the world, coal? We've been asking that question for over a year now, and we haven't heard any satisfactory answers. So we're launching a campaign against them both, Bank of America and Citi. And we're not alone. Rolling out starting this month, the banks can expect to be hearing from Rainforest Action Network and our allies in the streets, in the coal fields, in the health sector, and in boardrooms regularly. And they won't stop hearing from us until they step up and take leadership on climate by ceasing funding of new coal. As we've heard today, change has to happen fast. But we've also heard today that luckily there isn't any shortage of alternatives to coal. Quite the opposite. Together with renewable energy sector and the opportunities for implementing efficiency, America can meet its energy needs and then some while creating more jobs and a surge of investments by shifting their energy investments away from coal and towards alternatives.
You've been listening into a conference call for journalists as the Rainforest Action Network sets out to stop Citigroup and Bank of America from wrecking the world's climate by financing still more coal power plants. You heard Rebecca Tarbottom of RAN, author and activist Bill McKibben, Judy Bonds, the founder of Coal River Mountain Watch, plus Leslie Lowe of the Interfaith Council Center for Corporate Responsibility. This call was recorded October 2nd, 2007. You can get the longer version with questions from journalists at www.ran.org/presskit. If that disappears sometime, you can always download this file from the 2007 climate files of ecoshock.org. Check out RAN and help them stop these banks, stop this crazy coal madness.
Working in a coal mine, going down, down, down. Working in a coal mine, ooh, about to slip down.
You are listening to the Radio EcoShock Show, a weekly program available free to any nonprofit station. If your college or community station doesn't have EcoShock, ask them for it. Next week, we were supposed to cover the giant meltdown of the Arctic ice this year. We're getting a new ocean north of Canada, and it has scientists shivering about the future. But the problem is so large and so new, I found that experts are still trying to assess what this means. I'm still digging, and I don't want to bring you a show that isn't really ready. Instead, we'll be presenting a real eco-shocker. Two supposed environmentalists have once again pronounced the environmental movement is dead. Yes, the PR man Michael Schellenberger and his partner pollster Ted Nordhaus, called the bad boys of environmentalism for good reasons, have published a new book called Breakthrough from the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. In my opinion, it's a shoddy book with slash-and-burn pseudo-journalism, so join me for a two-program special on why this book sucks and the new wave of real living environmentalism. Expect fireworks. I'm your host, I should say senior radio analyst to follow the latest cheap trends, Alex Smith, and as always, I appreciate you taking the time to tune in to your world. Music this week has been Disco Inferno by Earth, Wind & Fire, Working in a Coal Mine by Lee Dorsey, an old classic, and Vancouver Island's Shane Phillip with the show's theme song, Mother Earth.
Great land, easily being passive while the aggressors are getting out of hand.